Hello. This is the first of some anniversary specials that I'll be doing as part of the radio show High Fidelity on WOW FM in Adelaide's western suburbs. We're going to be taking a look at albums that turn 20, 25 or 30, and albums that mean a lot to me that I've listened to quite a bit. So I'll be getting on local musicians and a lot of people from the Adelaide music scene to talk about albums that mean a lot to them. The very first one, this is the one that started it all. Trip Chester, local musician and artist, was running a tribute show to Nirvana's In Utero, and he and I spent 2 hours talking about the album and why we loved it. It's my first go at a podcast, so hopefully you'll enjoy listening to it. We'll try and have one out every month, and enjoy.
I'm being joined this week by artist, musician, sort of everyman Trip Chester. Trip, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Shannon. Thanks for having me.
And what's sort of your background and history in music in the Adelaide scene, Trip?
It gets a bit crazy. I've done all sorts of stuff. I've played in heavy bands, mellow bands, bands with female singers, played bass in a few bands. Athletic Teenage Joggers was one I was one with for a while. Last year, Your Loyal Heartless was a band I was with for a while. I've done heaps of hip-hop with SMP and a whole bunch of other local dudes through that avenue. I pretty much just sang hooks and stuff on their songs, though. Yeah. Did a verse every now and then, like, right. Challenged myself. I got some, like, rap roots, you know, so I was pretty much right into it. But, yeah, recently gone right back to stripped back, organic, acoustic type stuff. Great. Myself. I think Nirvana's brought that back out of me, mm-hmm. You know. It's just like squeezed all this extra stuff that's happened since the 90s out of me, and now I'm back to the 90s all over again.
There's a pretty big show going on at the Crown and Anchor on the 21st of September.
That's very true. Yes, yeah. Next Friday.
Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, I've got a bunch of dudes together to commemorate the album In Utero by Nirvana, which was their last studio album. And it's the 25th anniversary on that very day, that next Friday, the 21st.
Yeah, that was a pretty impressive getting it back on the actual day as well.
Kind of fluky. Like, I was in a band last year where we were just jamming out a Nirvana song just for the hell of it, pretty much to annoy our female singer. Just the in-between songs type thing. We just got carried away and we were like, this sounds all right. And just had the idea, a spark at that point, like, why don't we try and pull some kind of Nirvana gig off? And we just simply said, to, like, out in the open, In Utero, that could be about 25 years old. Let's look into that. And figured out it was going to be 25 years old this year, September. I made a phone call, tried to figure out if that day was available for a gig, and it was. So
beautiful. A quarter of a century. Scary. Yeah. Just, yeah, I remember buying it on the day it came out. And it's like, oh, that was 25 years ago. I'm getting too old. So we're going to go through the actual album, In Utero. We're going to go track by track, which I'm really looking forward to. Have a bit of a chance to talk about the gig itself, a little bit about all of the music that came from Nirvana, and a bit about your stuff as well.
Fantastic, man.
In Utero, is it play a pretty big part in your musical history?
Massive, yeah. It was, I got into Nevermind when it first came out, mm-hmm. But In Utero, I don't know, it just hit a chord with me a bit more. Deep, you know, like, I was just listening to this music going, I already like Nirvana, but I think I'm in love now. And it made me want to, you know, get a guitar and play music rather than just listen to it and enjoy it. And I just I guess it challenged me a lot, you know. There's a lot of heavy stuff on there that, mm-hmm. For me, that was into sort of like Hendrix and Nirvana up until that point. That album opened me up to a bit more angst, like a bit more heavy angst. And then that opened the doors up to millions of bands that, you know.
Well, this one's a lot more, I think, personal. But Nevermind, there's a lot more of what's going on in Kurt's life, I think, in this album. Do you remember, like, getting it when it came out?
Yeah, dude, I got it off of a dude in, I was in high school. Mm-hmm. I was in, like, year 9, I reckon. And I could hear music playing through someone else's headphones.
Right.
And I was thinking, that sounds like Nirvana. And they've got a certain sound, you know, and like, even back then, not being a musician, I was like, it's got to be Nirvana, but I don't know this song. So I tapped this guy on the shoulder. I was like, what are you listening to? And he's like, Nirvana. I was like, wow, what album's that? You know, I didn't know it was out yet.
Yeah.
And because I don't follow things. So he just goes, yeah, it's this album. Showed me the cover and that, and I just had a little bit of a listen in his headphone, and I said, can I borrow that tonight?
Yeah.
He's like, it's new. I don't want to lend it to you. I was like, seriously, I'll bring it back tomorrow morning. I'll just want to tape it because it's cassettes, you know. Took it home, taped it onto a cassette because you couldn't just download it back in those days, and just thrashed it for ages. Like, it's all I listened to. It just made me go insane. It was like so good.
So my entry into Nirvana was my sister was on exchange in America, and she came back and basically said, I bought you back two albums, I've only just been released and everyone was listening to them, and she dropped them in front of me and she went, here you go, see what you think. And I remember putting on Nevermind and going, what the hell is this? And just thinking, what is this? And listening to it a couple of times going, I don't know what I think of this. I think the Chili Peppers, I kind of thought, this is good because it's a bit catchier. It's got the hooks. And then I just kept on going back to Nevermind and just starting to go, this is really good. And then I remember In Utero, I was really worried because that all the stuff, Kurt was wearing the dress on stage, his hair was pink, all the interviews were basically these guys that looked like they didn't want to be there.
Sleazing.
All the press leading into In Utero was saying it's going to be unreleasable, it's terrible, no, the record company doesn't want to release it. I remember getting it on the day it came out. I was at uni, so a little bit older than you, my first year of uni, and turned up, put it on, and just thought, oh, this is different. I think that I still remember the first line of Serve the Servants, that teenage angst has paid off well and now I'm bored and old.
Says it all, doesn't it?
And just thinking, okay, this is going to be different because, it just that one line kind of tells you that this is going to be an album that we don't want it's to be Nevermind.
Perfect announcement.
Well, let's kick it off. Let's listen to Serve the Servants, track one off of Nirvana's In Utero. Serve the Servants there, which is track one off of Nirvana's In Utero, which is almost a depressing 25 years old. Trip Chester's in with me to talk about the album as we go through it track by track. We're going to throw in a couple of songs in between too, but that is a fair opening to an album, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah.
And it really was an album that the band decided they very clearly didn't want it to be Nevermind. Kurt was pretty vocal about not liking Nevermind.
It's got him too much attention and too much success.
Yeah, I think he talked a lot about he thought it was overproduced. And I think he said he didn't listen to it after it was released. He hadn't listened to it ever again.
Very produced album, though. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with chorus pedals, but I guess the intro to Come As You Are is like that chorus, that watery sound that you can put onto your guitar. Almost all of Nevermind sounds like there's a chorus pedal on it. Just about every riff, every guitar lick. But In Utero, there's not one.
Yeah.
Not one bit.
I think, I don't know. Butch Vig kind of seems like the type of producer that wants it to have a Butch Vig sound.
Yeah.
That, like, I want everyone to know I've been involved in this. But I still, I know they talk about it being, they don't like it overproduced, but I still think it sounds pretty rough and raw. It blew me away when it first came out.
It's got all the elements, like punk and all that sort of stuff's there.
Yeah.
It's dirty, it's angry, all that sort of stuff. But then In Utero is that times 10, you know.
And 2 weeks to record. Locked themselves in a studio. I was doing a little bit of research and reading about it. And they locked themselves in a little studio out in the country.
Yeah.
Only person allowed to visit was Courtney.
Yeah.
And she could only visit for small amounts of time. And Dave Grohl was saying, no drugs, no illicit substances. Yeah. It was, Steve Albini said, if we go in and we do it as fast as we can, it'll sound as raw as we need it to sound.
Cool.
And I think he's quoted as saying, any album that if an album takes longer than a week to record, there's something wrong.
Yeah, right.
This one took two, but it's still nice and raw. And they said most songs less than three takes to get
fantastic.
It down. You can really pick that rawness in it too.
You can, yeah. Apparently, like, I've heard things like the original Heart-Shaped Box solo went for 5-10 minutes or something like that, and they had to cut it back to, like, 30 seconds few seconds anyway. Yeah, it's just really awesome. Like, even the bonus track that you usually get with the Nirvana album, the secret track, that's awesome, and it sounds very ad-lib. Raw as.
So. It's like 25 minutes after break.
Nevermind had Endless Nameless.
Yeah.
And it's the type of thing you think you couldn't recreate, but they kind of did.
Yeah. Now, 1993, I had a look. In America, Mariah Carey's Dream Lover was number one. We don't have that tonight.
Track.
I was going to play it, but we're going to run out of time.
I was going to send it to you and say, How about that one?
You've got the guitar. Can you hit the high notes?
I'd try. I will fail.
And in Australia, Meatloaf's I Would Do Anything For Love, But I Won't Do That was right in the middle of its eight-week run at number one.
I know, 8 weeks. I can remember getting more and more angry. Every time. I was still there.
Yeah. So that's kind of the environment that this album came out in.
The tone was just, so everything was so overglossed and beautiful and pretty and dramatic.
There was that feeling, whenever I look back, there's that feeling that just after Nevermind, you had just grunge take over and it was everywhere. But when you look at the charts, no, it was still fringe music because the charts were still your Meatloafs and your Mariah Careys and Celine Dion's. But there was great music out there if you went out to look for it.
And Neuter hardly made it into the charts, really, didn't it?
I think it made it number two here, but not for very long.
No, Heart-Shaped Box did okay.
Yeah, the singles didn't do well. There was only two of them too, which I think, that was in the 50s, I think.
It's pretty crazy, isn't it?
It was. I was thinking it's a little strange because this was an album that they pretty much said they want to lose fans over it. They want to get rid of the casual fans.
Yeah.
Which they did. A lot of people went, nah, I'm done with Nirvana.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And then Unplugged came out.
Let it reversed it. Again.
Everyone's mum was starting to go, ooh, I like this. What album is this one?
Yeah.
So 93, what you were saying, Year 9? Do you remember any of the other stuff you were listening to?
Cypress Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, top 40 stuff, because that was just what everyone was listening to.
Yeah.
So, but there was a lot of sort of this like a pop hip-hop stuff happening.
Yep.
There was Salt and Pepper and...
Oh, yes.
Adele the Funky Homo Sapien, mm-hmm. I think, that sort of stuff, you know? All that like new, just really pop hip-hop stuff. Nirvana didn't fit in at all. Like, it was such a weird time. That's why I was so relieved to find that dude had Nirvana in his headphones, because he was a very avid like hip-hop listener himself. That's what I dug my head in.
And we got track two now, Scentless Apprentice, which you mentioned is a bit of a tough one live.
Oh, it's there's a lot of screaming.
Resting the day after.
I have been training. This is like Olympic training. It's insane.
And Scentless Apprentice is the only one listed as all three band members being involved in writing it.
Yeah, right.
It's the only one that's not
a
Kurt Cobain. Again, in a bit of my research, it's based on a book about a guy that works for a perfume creator who has amazing smell but no body odor of his own. So the Scentless Apprentice comes from that. And supposedly it was Dave Grohl's idea and saying, look, I like this, we should turn it into a song.
Wow.
And Kurt dismissed it as rubbish and a stupid idea, but wrote it anyway and the band put it out. So I guess that's why everybody else got songwriting credits too.
I bet you Kurt got really interested as soon as Dave started the drum beat at the very start of the song.
It's a great start, isn't it?
It is. And I know Kurt's an ex-drummer as well, like an original. He thought he was going to be a drummer. Originally, so he would have heard that beat and gone, hell yeah. I mean, when we play it, when we rehearse it, it's just so powerful.
Yeah, I used to get a guitar and go and visit my mate that had a drum kit, and we'd just bang out and Smells Like Teen Spirit endlessly over and over again. But I remember trying to kick out this drum beat on his drum kit every now and again, and just trying to get as fast as you can on that kick pedal.
Yeah, awesome.
And not doing it very often.
You can never do it. Like, when someone can do it, you just go, that's a freaking drummer, right?
Yeah, that was always the, I wonder if I can get it to sound like it. It's like, nah, okay, I'll go back to trying to play this dodgy U2 beat that's much, much easier. All right, let's take a listen to Scentless Apprentice. Number two, this is the second track from In Utero. That was Scentless Apprentice, just finishing off there. I just realised it's 10:30 and we're only two tracks in.
Well done.
There we go. So, Scentless Apprentice. Next one was kind of the single. It's the one that a lot of people know from In Utero. It's a lot that people only really know it for, Heart-Shaped Box. And this is one that they brought Scott Litt in to redo. I think the band and Steve Albini had a few differences in opinion,
and
the record label definitely, I think Geffen definitely had a difference of opinion with the album. And REM producer Scott Litt came in, and I think the main thing was the change in the solo, and then he brought in the harmonies as well on the chorus. And I think like the 20th anniversary of the album, they've got the Scott Litt version and the Steve Albini version.
Yeah, I still haven't listened to that.
I haven't heard the original like Steve Albini mix of it, but they reckon a different solo, different sound. But I still like this. It seems to stick a little bit out from the album. It's almost a little bit more easy to listen to than a lot of the tracks on here.
I think it's a perfection song, that one, you know, the way it's come up on the album eventually.
It is.
It's just, it's magical sound. It's ridiculous. The harmonies I reckon do make it as well. In the verse even, they're very subtle, but they're like, they're hauntingly beautiful, you know.
This will be a fun one to play live.
It's awesome live. Yeah. I've got to remember to play it slower though, because the energy's always like up, and then it's like, that song's actually like a bit slow.
And this one, and I guess a fair few of them, there'll be a fair bit of singing along on the 21st.
I'm hoping so, because that's what Nirvana's all about. It's like energy,
belting
energy
it out.
Exchange, crowd participation.
Yeah.
Hoping the people that come are coming to try and get that experience of seeing a Nirvana show, and that's what I want to try and give them too. So,
and I'm sure they'll be coming from a bit of a love of the band and a love of the album, definitely.
You'd hope so.
And a little bit of nostalgia from 25 years ago too.
Yes.
So we'll take a listen to Heart-Shaped Box. Now, the next one is probably maybe the most controversial track on the album.
It's quite easy to pick that straight from the title, isn't it?
Yeah, with Rape Me. Quite misunderstood a lot, too.
It's funny that every time we rehearse it, I'm like, all right, next is Rape Me. And I always say, it's the song, guys, all right, just don't get excited.
Another thing I was looking at is Walmart, I think, in America, weren't going to stock the album because of
that.
The cover art on the back with all the dolls and the fetuses. They didn't like that, and they didn't like this. So they actually said to the band, you got to change it.
Wow.
And I figured that's where Nirvana would go, nah. But supposedly Kurt and Chris said, well, as kids, the only place we were allowed to buy music was Walmart.
Yeah.
We couldn't go to record stores and things, so we want the kids that are in our position to be able to buy our stuff. So they said yes, and then they gave about 3 or 4 different suggestions, and Walmart went, nah, look, it's got to fit in the space of the word rape, because we got to stick it over the top. So Kurt went for Wave Me.
Yeah, I remember
saying
that.
Yeah, and they put that on the back, and then they changed the back. It looks similar, but it's got turtles and stuff on it.
What?
Which is just a bit bizarre. But I guess with the title, you probably, I don't know if you're getting a song called Rape Me played on the radio these days.
Wow. No, it'd be a bit brutal. And the way he's singing it, I guess at the time it makes sense, but
yeah.
But now, and it feels weird playing it, I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. Well, yeah. Listening to some interviews with him as well, he's actually, like, 25 years ago was saying a lot of things that are only really being discussed now sort of some of the equal rights and the feminism and anti-sexual harassment. He was
onto
doing
it.
A lot of interviews that kind of have only really become mainstream in the media at the moment. He was talking about it a lot.
And that's why he liked doing stuff like wearing dresses on stage.
Yeah.
And he wanted to challenge people's perceptions. Absolutely. All the time. Yeah.
I think he wanted to annoy people so that they'd leave and he'd be left with the people that he sort of felt he had something in common with.
Yeah. And that's exactly what. Apparently, when he went on tour, he would always end up chatting with young people all the time, just because he got along with them.
Yeah.
Always young musos come up, well, I love your stuff, and that was the sort of people you engage with more.
Yeah.
Whereas you got people his age that were like, rah, rah, rah in his face. He just thought, you're a massive douchebag.
Yeah. Well, I think another quote I read was Steve Albini saying that he thought Nirvana were REM with a fuzz box when he first heard them. He didn't like them.
Yeah, right.
And then the band kind of said, look, we really want to work with you because you did Surfer Rosa by the Pixies and you did The Breeders' Pod, and they're our favourite albums. We definitely want to work with you. So he kind of said, yeah, okay, let's do it if this is what you really want to do. Which is a pretty cool way to get a producer. Yeah. And then they kind of split a little bit apart, not necessarily agreeing with the way that it went.
Yeah.
But should we get into Rape Me? We'll make sure we can get through the album before the 2 hours is up. But there's no one on at 12, so we can keep going if we have to. Let's take a listen to Rape Me. This is, what's this, track four? Track five.
Four.
Track four off of the album. That is a statement, that song, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I guess you'd notice, too, they never just dim the guitar and finish. There's always a bit of playing around with the feedback at the end of nearly all the songs on here.
Yeah.
Now, next we got Frances Farmer Will Have Her Revenge on Seattle, which you were saying a long title, which they chose on purpose as a bit of a dig at all the other Seattle alternative bands, sort of Pearl Jam style, going for the one-word songs.
One-word titles,
So Kurt going, let's make this a big long one. Now, you were saying off when we were in between songs that this one's fun to play live.
Yeah, it's so much fun. Everyone has big smiles on their faces as soon as I say, oh, next is Frances Farmer. Yeah, let's do it. It's fun. All the on-off distortion and really cool sort of breakdown riff in the middle there.
Yeah.
It just like takes off.
There's another one. Well, this one's based on an actress, Frances Farmer.
Yeah, I saw the movie about a year ago.
Yeah, 1930s.
Crazy actor. Movie. The lady from, she's in, I can't remember her name now, but she's in all the American Horror Story movies. Mm-hmm. It's her like younger acting as Frances Farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it's about a reporter that gets totally messed up,
yep.
screwed over by the corporate world, being a lady, trying to be an awesome lady with a voice. Yeah, like you're saying, like, you know, Kurt was an advocate for all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and he was saying he kind of sympathised with her and thought this is someone from earlier that I kind of feel as a kindred spirit and put it together. And this is one that... I was talking about R.E.M. with you a little bit before, that Michael Stipe from R.E.M., who became pen pals with Kurt Cobain, said was really inspired their album Monster.
Yeah.
And a couple of the tracks on Monster were going heavier because he kind of wanted to go for a bit of the Nirvana sound. And then there was an interview with Kurt after that was talking about the Unplugged that they did.
Yep.
And he was saying that the next Nirvana album he would like to see would be more acoustic and
more like
almost
REM.
Orchestral to be a bit like R.E.M.
Yeah, yeah. I remember him saying that as well.
And Michael Stipe was saying he tried to organise a collaboration of the two of them doing an album together when he thought Kurt was going down a really dark hole.
Yeah.
He was saying he was really concerned for him and saying, let's do an album together. I just think...
It would have been pretty amazing.
That would have been a pretty good album, Although it could have ended up being just one of those really self-indulgent things that you go, why did they do this?
Yeah, he did. What he Kurt tried to team up with someone else. They tried to do a blues album, 12-bar blues album. Mm-hmm. I think it was with Mark Lanegan.
Right.
And they just totally like got too smashed and stuffed it up and it never went anywhere.
Well, let's take a listen to Frances Farmer. We'll have her revenge on Seattle on 100.5 WOW FM. Oh, this one has a long intro, so we'll just chat for a little bit longer as we go.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of just has this little
distortion wheel kick in and interrupts.
And is that fun when you just get to kick the pedal and off you go?
Oh, hell yeah.
All right, this is WOW FM. That was Frances Farmer. We'll have her revenge on Seattle. Now, this is one, I guess, goes a little bit more acoustic. I always think listening to this one, what Kurt Cobain would think of TV at the moment. This one is about just
totally
how he just has a bit of disdain for just the real stupid people that consume anything passed along to them. And we're going to kick straight from Dumb to Very Ape as well, so that we can make sure we get through all of this before we hit midnight.
Yeah.
And you were saying Very Ape, Fast and Fun?
Fast and Fun, yeah. It starts up, ramps up, you're having the best time, and then it's over.
Mm.
It's a quickie.
And I found it was going to be called Perky or Punky New Wave Number.
Was it?
Yeah.
That would suit it. Quite a cool title.
Quite a lot of songs that they had sort of working titles with that they kind of missed, and they say a lot about the album too. It's Take You Down to the Pavement, 9 month media blackout, La 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 alternative anthem was all the politics. And they had famously, this album was going to be called I Hate Myself and I Want to Die,
which
they then later did as the song, but everyone said, even the band said, no, Kurt, we can't do that. I think Chris said, if we do that, a kid will kill themselves and we'll all get sued.
Yeah,
and they
much.
Kind of went, yeah, fair enough. All right, we'll take a listen to Dumb and then Very Ape. Trip, you've kind of got the special thing of normally I get guests in and we do a Semaphore 5. They pick like a theme and five songs to go with it. You've managed to get a whole album.
Yeah, lucky me.
It's pretty good. It's good that it's a great album too. Trip's with me at the moment. We're going through the album itself and we're at Milk It, which I was saying this is the track that I probably tend to skip. I kind of feel it's a, I don't know, it's a bit of a weaker track on the album, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it's like it's one of the strongest for me.
I don't know. I just feel like this one's almost like a jam that they didn't quite turn into a song.
Well, the guitar leads definitely sound like that. I think that's Kurt being deliberately, I don't give a shit. Bit of a punk ass attitude, but just the brutal mellow to heavy on this song particularly is crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy good.
I think there's like I don't know. I just feel with this one, it was almost all too obvious that we don't want people to like this one. And I think there's other songs that do that better.
Yeah,
I think like
yeah.
Tourette's or some of those kind of
Tourette's just, does it. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, it does it, but it does it more as a song rather than as a collection of riffs and stuff. But it'd be interesting to, like, pretty tricky doing this live with the band, with the changes and
this
everything else in it.
This one was the hardest one to learn. This one's we still sort of go, oh, shit, here we go.
Yeah.
Before we play it. But I think on the night, the vibe would be there, definitely.
Have you guys had plenty of rehearsals?
Yeah, we've been rehearsing every week for the last couple of months now.
That'd be good fun.
Yeah, you look forward to it.
Yeah, you're not getting sick of the songs?
Never, no. Because it's sounding better every time, you know. Like, the first jam was a bit rough, but still good.
Yeah.
You know, but now you look back at the first jam and go, that was actually nowhere near it.
All right, let's take a listen to Milk It. And this is, in case you haven't worked it out, this is off Nirvana's In Utero. That was Milk It by Nirvana. Now, Trip, the next one I would say is going to be a pretty massive sing-along on the night.
Oh, yeah, definitely a sing-along song. It's very powerful, double vocal in it as well, in the chorus, real anthemic.
Yeah.
A bit slower, chilled. Everyone's heard it on Unplugged.
Yeah, I think I prefer the Unplugged one.
It's a different key.
Yeah, I don't know. His voice in the Unplugged version is just... It's on point. It's amazing.
Totally different key, and he's singing it. It's a whole different vibe. Yeah, you're right. I actually probably prefer that one myself, but I don't reckon I could sing that one because that's like Kurt's higher range in that one.
Yeah.
This album one's not too bad.
Well, I still remember this song as the one that opened up Leonard Cohen to me as a youngster, because it's like, oh, who's this Leonard Cohen guy they're talking about? And I remember there was a joke about Leonard Cohen in an episode of The Young Ones that I didn't get
because
I didn't know who Leonard Cohen was. And there was an REM cover of a Leonard Cohen song.
Yep.
So Nirvana name checks him in here, and I just went, oh, I'm going to go and find a Leonard Cohen album and listen to it. And I'm a big fan of his songwriting.
Yeah, cool.
The man's lyrics are amazing. This is a great song about Kurt drinking pennyroyal tea for the stomach ulcer that he was continually talking about in interviews and everything, saying that's where the anger came from, the pain he felt from the stomach.
Yeah.
I think that was even mentioned in the infamous suicide note as well.
I think it was, it was grinding at him all the time. He said that he became a junkie because he already felt like one or something.
Have you been down the deep, terrible hole of the conspiracy theories about the murder or the suicide? Or
I looked at the first thing that came out. There was a crappy movie that was released.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just this guy walking around. Did you think Courtney Love killed Kurt Cobain?
Yep.
Talking to... It was ridiculous.
Clutching at straws stuff.
I was like, no, he was a very suicidal man. Yeah. I mean, that might be easy to frame him. That doesn't mean, you know. Speaking of suicide, anyway, like the whole event next Friday is a charity thing for local suicide prevention networks.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, that's the, we're not doing it for ourselves to make some money. It's going to be a cheap door charge, probably like $5 or something like that. And any donation beyond that goes... that and any donation beyond that goes to a network of suicide prevention services.
Fantastic. It's a great course because it comes up when you talk about Nirvana. It's kind of the unavoidable thing. And it was only about 5 or 6 months after this album
not long after.
He was at that point in his life.
Yeah.
And do you remember it?
I do. I remember finding out about it secondhand because you didn't find out about everything back then.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like there was a Facebook thing and everyone knows about it straight away. I was at school and a teacher said, what do you think everyone in Adelaide's sad today?
Yeah.
But he didn't mean that. Some girl in the class goes, because Kurt Cobain killed himself.
Yeah.
And I was like, what?
I remember driving to uni and Helen Razor doing the morning show on Triple J.
Yeah.
Just, you could tell it was such a massive thing for her. Listening to her go through it and just going, wow. This, and for me, this was the first musician that I felt a connection with that died. So it was a pretty big thing.
I remember thinking, why would he do that? Because he had always talent and the energy that you got from what he was doing with his art. You just sort of thought, that's a massive throwaway in that sense. But then you look into his life and you sort of see all the things that were challenging him, not that
exactly
it's like, an excuse or anything, but there was a lot of shit happening.
Yeah,
poor guy.
Ending up in some dark places.
And he isolated himself around that time, which is the main thing. And
let's take a listen to one of the slower, but one of the, well, okay, it kicks in, doesn't it? Penny Royalty from In Euro by Nirvana. This is 100.5 WOW FM. Penny Royalty there by Nirvana, of course, from 1993. And I am talking to Trip Chester, and we're having a chat about the special coming up next Friday at the Cranker, the 25th anniversary of the release of Nirvana's In Utero. I think that would be a great one live.
Oh, yeah, man.
I reckon I'll come along just to sing along to that.
Just to that one, yeah. Right.
But stay for the whole time, absolutely.
Yeah, the dude doing backups with me at the end of that song always looks very, like he's maybe just climaxed or something. Yeah. Yeah, he loves it. He's like,
fair enough. I think the second big giveaway that tells you a lot about this album is you've got that first line, Teenage Angst has paid off well, now I'm bored and old. Mm-hmm. I think the title of this next track kind of tells you what they're thinking.
Yeah.
It's definitely a bit of a dig at every other band with the radio-friendly unit shifter.
Yep, and it's a song that doesn't quite hit the mark of what that would represent, you know?
Like, yeah, well,
deliberately.
It's another one I looked at where Kurt said it's just random lines thrown together. It's not something that he put a big message into. He just put random lines together, but there's definitely a bit of there's a story to the song,
and there's a wailing guitar like a noise and that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
a lot of it in this track. It's really cool song.
It is. Let's take a listen. Oh, I'm gonna skip that Zach's pick. This is a radio friendly unit shifter. You're on 100.5 WOW FM, the show's High Fidelity. My name's Shannon. I've got Trip Chester here with me, and there's only about 20 minutes left of the show, and we've got two official songs from the album
to
go.
Two songs left, really. We've done all right.
We have done pretty well. I guess, though, if we play the full album, we've got to sit here for 20 minutes in silence while we go through to the hidden track at the end, but that's probably not good radio.
It's just a hidden track, it's okay. It's hidden for a reason.
So are you going to include the silence when you play this live?
No, we're not doing gallons of rubbing alcohol either.
Yeah.
We thought about it and we're like, probably rather just play another track that people actually know.
Yeah, I think as an audience, maybe it's not the most interesting one to finish off the night.
Not a good closer for a live gig.
Yeah, no, not so much. But this one, definitely a good one to play.
Oh, yeah.
I think this was Kurt talking about his fear of becoming an old man and swearing at everyone. And so he wrote this song about it, Tourette's. Yeah, I really like the punk feel of this. I think this is probably the closest of their later stuff that comes close to their early stuff, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this has got a bit of a Bleach vibe to it when I listen to it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm. It's pretty flat out, though, isn't it?
Flat-out
track.
Seems to have a little bit of that Melvins-type early Nirvana feel
of it
to
like
it.
That, but, yeah, I can see that.
I really enjoy this one on the track when it comes up. It's it's good fun to listen to. Let's kick into it, or we're going to run out of time, Trip.
Let's do it.
This is Tourette's off, what is this, the 12th track off of In Utero?
The 11th track.
11th track off of In Utero. Okay, let's take a listen. Short, sweet and fast, that one. That's a 1 minute 35 seconds.
Yeah.
That's a rocking minute and 35, though.
Those vocals, man. On the album cover, where it's got all the lyrics for every song. I think that one just says cuff tisk snips. And if you like figure out the anagram of that, it still swears.
Yeah. You're in for a bit of a challenge with that one on the night.
Yeah, definitely. It's mood. It's all mood.
Yeah, it's probably lucky it comes at the end of the album. You definitely want it to be one of the first tracks for the night.
It's like, I've got to hold back a little bit on that because it can go, because it's all mood.
Yeah.
You can go a little bit too far and actually lose your voice quite easily with that track. It's just anger.
And then it completely flips around to all apologies.
Yeah, it's a bit more chilled.
Yeah, this is probably, I always feel All Apologies is one of the Nirvana songs that people know them for and that everybody kind of knows as well. This one was the one that really made it big on Unplugged as well.
Unplugged's huge on Unplugged.
Yeah, and it's beautiful on Unplugged as well. And this was it's dedicated to Courtney and Francis. As a song, which they didn't tend to do very often, just dedicated to people. But he was quite often in interviews saying that things had turned around. He'd had the wife, he'd had the baby in the short amount of time, and everything was starting to look good.
Yeah, true, but he was mixed up, wasn't he?
Yes, and Courtney's definitely a very interesting lady.
Interesting.
I was actually, when we were talking about NoFX a bit earlier, their biography, the Hepatitis Bathtub.
Yeah, yeah.
She's in there. Like, she, before Nirvana, was spending a lot of time with the drummer of NoFX and in a pretty bad state, both of them, with some pretty bad things that they were taking. And it's just interesting, just kind of think, oh, she went from there and then moved across. So,
she was with Corgan for a while, too.
Yeah, yeah.
With Corgan. She's
still doing interesting things, claiming the other, not that long ago, that Heart-Shaped Box was written about hers. Despite all the interviews before that with Kurt saying it's about a lot of other things.
I've heard some like bootleg stuff of Kurt playing some of the songs from Live Through This.
Oh, really?
Like, with her. Like, yeah. It's almost like he's teaching her
song. Wow.
It's like, okay, and it ended up being really iconic tracks.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But they're very Kurtish. I like the lyrics, everything about them.
Like yeah.
Chord structures and all that. Either they hung out so much that she was being heavily influenced or he helped her a lot.
I think he might have given her a hand.
You can hear it, totally. Because all the albums after that, they're nothing like it.
Yeah. Now, this is the track that when you click on it, says it plays for about 32 minutes. But we do have all of that silence before we get to gallons of rubbing alcohol flow through the strip. But we might skip that one because I think it starts 24 minutes after.
Yeah, we can skip that. We'll just get to the end of the track and get out.
And this will be another big sing-along on the night.
I think so, yeah.
It's a great song. Let's take a listen to All Apologies. Well, we have made it through all of In Utero by Nirvana, except Trip for the bonus track hidden all the way in the back, but we might skip that one. But we've got about 10 minutes left in the night, so we can go through the B-sides because I've got the box set with all of the Nevermind singles and all of these ones with some of the B-sides. Yeah. I remember buying that purely to be able to get the lyrics to all of Nevermind, which was on there. Because pre-internet days, you couldn't just type it up. And I do remember that as a kid, sort of 16, 17, I had this friend who was a lot older than me. I used to play sport with him, and he had this computer that was connected to this thing called the internet. And it was this magic box that he could bring me tab for guitar.
Yeah, so it used to freak me out.
We'd play tennis on a Saturday, and I'd give him a list of songs, and he'd go to his work, and he would download the tab, he'd print it out, he'd bring it back to me, and I'd just go, this is incredible. And it was just
it's magic.
All Nirvana stuff. I was like, wow, I don't know what this internet thing is, but it sounds good. That's how long I was actually at my uni at a time where there was a room that had the internet computers connected to it.
I can remember asking someone what the internet was for the first time when I heard it was been talked about a bit around me, and I said to one of my mates' dads who I knew computers,
yep.
So what is the internet? And he's explaining it to me, and I remember my first comment back was, so a computer in one house can connect to a computer in another house? What?
It'll never catch on.
How?
All right, well, let's go with the first single, which really, this is Marigold. Which is basically Dave's song.
Kind of like the first Foo Fighters song ever, really.
And it really sounds like a Foo Fighters song as well. It sounds like a later Foo Fighters song more than the first album, too. And I guess it's hard to discuss Nirvana without the Foo Fighters kind of looming over them, I think.
Definitely.
There's like a later generation that see Nirvana as Dave Grohl's first band rather than Dave Grohl as the guy from Nirvana.
Yeah, exactly.
And Dave's definitely, people have strong opinions of him.
They do.
Yeah.
He kind of rejected Nirvana for a while at first. I found he was, any fans that were wearing Nirvana shirts, now you kind of laugh.
Yeah, well, they used to get really annoyed that when they first started playing as the Foo Fighters, they would just have a whole bunch of guys in Nirvana t-shirts yelling Marigold because it was the only song they knew, so that was all they could request.
When they played at Somersault from the first album to Dave still had his long hair straight out of Nirvana, I remember I was crowd. This is my first time crowd surfing around the place and stuff like that. And
missing Somersault is one of my biggest concert regrets.
He played one song. He played one song where no one knew it. He was one of his. He goes, "You haven't heard this one. It's going to make you cry." And so everyone stopped, got lead lighters out and shit, right?
Yeah.
At the entertainment center, and these two big buff dudes like next to me go, you want to go up, mate? And I was like, yeah, right. They shut me up. I could just hear so many disapproving people underneath me.
Yeah.
But I was had my long bleached hair.
Yeah.
Long sleeves under short sleeves. My Chuck Taylor shoes. I looked like I want to be Kurt Cobain. Yeah. Right. And getting passed over the barrier right in front of Dave Grohl. He's looking me in the eyes and he laughed. He's looking at me like, you're an idiot, mate.
Yeah. Did you see them with Weezer at Cooper Stadium?
No, I didn't. That would have been cool.
Yeah, I don't know. It was a little strange. Like, I enjoyed it, but I couldn't help but feel that that almost become the bands that Nirvana started because of. That, like, they kind of started as edgy and punky because they were kind of rebelling against stadium rock and about the bands that were all about long extended solos. And I got the feeling that it was a lot about that'd become that big stadium arena band with it's my solo, now it's your solo, now it's his. Everybody, I'm going to clap my hands, you all clap your hands at the same time.
I'm not into that sort of shit.
No, it just didn't quite feel right. It's like, hang on. Like, but I guess,
heard people say that he's does annoyingly long solos and stuff.
It just comes across as a little self-indulgent, but I guess it's like,
he's a big personality.
In 25 years, you don't want to be the same person you were 25 years ago. If he's still playing stuff that sounds exactly like Nirvana and being just like the kid from Nirvana, you'd be going, that guy needs to grow up.
Well, I was telling you before, Mark Curtis, who'll be playing at the show, did the Dave Grohl lookalike stunt.
Yeah.
Started this year where he got in a limousine, hired by his friends, put on some sunglasses so he looked even more like Dave Grohl, because he gets that a lot, and drove laps around the entertainment center signing autographs.
That's genius.
Telling people that they hope they enjoy the show and stuff, and he made it into the advertiser. Bit of online articles saying "Have Fufu Fooled You," I think that was the title.
And that's something you think the band would actually go, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. You'd think, you'd hope so.
Yeah,
you'd hope he hasn't changed enough.
But they still seem keen to get people out of the crowd and let them play and still mix with the fans. But let's take a listen to very super early kind of Foo Fighters. This is Dave Grohl's. They kind of Ringo style Let the Drummer Have a Song.
Yeah.
And this was what he came up with. This is Marigold, which was the B-side of, I think, All Apologies.
All Apologies, I reckon, yeah.
All right, we'll take a listen. Marigold there, which is a B-side off of In Utero. And because it's pretty much Midnight Trip, we're going to go for the other B-side from In Utero.
Yep. Great title for a song again.
Yes.
Was it Rape Me a Single? And this was the B-side?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
And it's called Moist Vagina.
Yeah, which he mentions quite a bit in the song. Yeah, it's interesting. You can almost understand why this didn't make it onto the album and became a B-side.
Yeah, it's very unknown too. When I've shown people in the past, they've gone, wow, that's wow.
And it won't be getting a spin on Friday night?
I wish. Not that prepared for that, but maybe in the future. The band that I'm playing with next Friday night, they're going to turn into pretty much a band now.
Oh, fantastic.
Original band.
Yeah.
Made a bit of a bond.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a shitload of songs.
Yeah.
And we're going to keep going. So
fantastic.
We'll probably pull out the old Nirvana cover here and there when we're playing live.
That'd be great. Well, send through anything you record. We'll put it on Trip.
Yeah. No,
we haven't even had a chance to have you play live.
Oh, it's all right. We don't need to do that.
I'm happy to. I can have you on another time and we'll do a 745 gig playing live as well. Yeah. We kind of only just got through the album too. We'll take a listen Moist Vagina. And if you can, make sure you get out to the Cranker next Friday to see Trip and band play In Utero, all of those amazing tracks we've just heard, front to back. And then there'll be an encore of a couple of encores,
yeah.
Interesting songs.
It's a surprise.
People should come along to hear what's played.
Surprise element will be good, I believe. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Trip, huge thanks for hanging out with me for the 2 hours. I haven't had a guest stay for the 2 hours.
It's
quite nice to have some company right at the end of the station.
I love it.
It's not fun. Leave this studio on my own right in the middle of the night. All right. Well, you're on 100.5 WOW FM.